this. Operating on the wrong patient or the wrong side of the body is exceedingly rare, too. But the checks to prevent such errors are relatively quick and already accepted in several countries, including the United States. Such mistakes also get a lot of attention. So those checks stayed in. In contrast, our checks to prevent communication breakdowns tackled a broad and widely recognized source of failure. But our approach, having people formally introduce themselves and briefly discuss critical aspects of a given case, was far from proven effective. Improving teamwork was so fundamental to making a difference, however, that we were willing to leave these measures in and give them a try. After our London meeting, we did more small-scale testing, just one case at a time. We had a team in London try the draft checklist and give us suggestions, then a team in Hong Kong. With each successive round, the checklist got better. After a certain point, it seemed we had done all we could. We had a checklist we were ready to circulate. The final WHO safe surgery checklist spelled out 19 checks in all. Before anesthesia, there are 7 checks. The team members confirm that the patient, or the patient's proxy, has personally verified his or her identity and also given consent for the procedure. They make sure that the surgical site is marked and that the pulse oximeter, which monitors oxygen levels, is on the patient and working. They check the patient's medication allergies. They review the risk of airway problems, the most dangerous aspect of general anesthesia, and that appropriate equipment and assistance for them are available. And lastly, if there is a possibility of losing more than half a liter of blood, or the equivalent for a child, they verify that necessary intravenous lines, blood, and fluids are ready. After anesthesia, but before incision, come 7 more checks. The team members make sure they've been introduced by name and role. They confirm that everyone has the correct patient and procedure, including which side of the body, left versus right, in mind. They confirm that antibiotics were either given on time or were unnecessary. They check that any radiology images needed for the operation are displayed. And to make sure everyone is briefed as a team, they discuss the critical aspects of the case. The surgeon reviews how long the operation will take, the amount of blood loss the team should prepare for, and anything else people should be aware of. The anesthesia staff review their anesthetic plans and concerns, and the nursing staff review equipment availability, sterility, and their patient concerns. Finally, at the end of the operation, before the team wheels the patient from the room, come 5 final checks. The circulating nurse verbally reviews the recorded name of the completed procedure for accuracy, the labeling of any tissue specimens going to the pathologist, whether all needles, sponges, and instruments have been accounted for, and whether any equipment problems need to be addressed before the next case. Everyone on the team also reviews aloud their plans and concerns for the patient's recovery after surgery to ensure information is complete and clearly transmitted. Operations require many more than 19 steps, of course, but like builders, we tried to encompass the simple to the complex, with several narrowly specified checks to ensure stupid stuff isn't missed, antibiotics, allergies, the wrong patient, and a few communication checks to ensure people work as a team to recognize the many other potential traps and subtleties. At least that was the idea. But would it work and actually make a measurable difference in reducing harm to patients? That was the question. To find the answer, we decided to study the effect of the Safe Surgery Checklist on patient care in 8 hospitals around the world. This number was large enough to provide meaningful results while remaining manageable for my small research team and the modest budget WHO agreed to furnish. We got dozens of applications from hospitals seeking to participate. We set a few criteria for selection. The hospital's leader had to speak English. We could translate the checklist for staff members, but we didn't have the resources for daily communication with 8 site leaders in multiple languages. The location had to be safe for travel. We received, for instance, an enthusiastic application from the chief of surgery in an Iraqi hospital, which would have been fascinating, but conducting a research trial in a war zone seemed unwise. I also wanted a wide diversity of participating hospitals, hospitals in rich countries, poor countries, and in between. This insistence caused a degree of consternation at WHO headquarters. As officials explained, WHO's first priority is, quite legitimately, to help the poorer parts of the world, and the substantial costs of paying for data collection in wealthier countries would divert resources from elsewhere. But I had seen surgery in places ranging from rural India to Harvard, and seen failure across the span. I thought the checklist might make a difference anywhere, and if it worked in high-income countries, that success might help persuade poorer facilities to take it up. So we agreed to include wealthier sites if they agreed to support most, if not all, the research costs themselves. Lastly, the hospitals had to be willing to allow observers to measure their actual rates of complications, deaths, and systems failures in surgical care before and after adopting the checklist. Granting this permission was no small matter for hospitals. Most, even those in the highest income settings, have no idea of their current rates. Close observation was bound to embarrass some. Nonetheless, we got 8 willing hospitals lined up from all over the globe. 4 were in high-income countries and among the leading hospitals in the world: the University of Washington Medical Center in Seattle, Toronto General Hospital in Canada, St. Mary's Hospital in London, and Auckland City Hospital, New Zealand's largest. 4 were intensely busy hospitals in low- or middle-income countries: Philippines General Hospital in Manila, which was twice the size of the wealthier hospitals we enrolled, Prince Hamza Hospital in Amman, Jordan, a new government facility built to accommodate Jordan's bursting refugee population, St. Stephen's Hospital in New Delhi, an urban charity hospital, and St. Francis Designated District Hospital in Ifakara, Tanzania, the lone hospital serving a rural population of nearly 1 million people. This was an almost ridiculous range of hospitals to study. Annual healthcare spending in the high-income countries reached the thousands of dollars per person, while in India, the Philippines, and East Africa, it did not rise above the double digits. So, for example, the budget of the University of Washington Medical Center, over $1 billion per year, was more than twice that of the entire country of Tanzania. Surgery, therefore, differed starkly in our 8 hospitals. On the one end of the spectrum were those with state-of-the-art capabilities allowing them to do everything from robotic prostatectomies to liver transplants, along with factory loads of planned, low-risk, often day surgery procedures like hernia repairs, breast biopsies, and ear tube placements for drainage of chronic ear infections in children. On the other end were hospitals forced by lack of staff and resources to prioritize urgent operations. Emergency cesarean sections for mothers dying in childbirth, for example, or procedures for repair of severe traumatic injuries. Even when the hospitals did the same operations, an appendectomy, a mastectomy, the placement of a rod and a broken femur, the conditions were so disparate that the procedures were the same only in name. In the poorer hospitals, the equipment was meager, the team's training was more limited, and the patients usually arrived sicker, the appendix having ruptured, the breast cancer having grown twice as large, the femur proving not only broken, but infected. Nonetheless, we went ahead with our 8 institutions. The goal, after all, was not to compare one hospital with another, but to determine where, if anywhere, the checklist could improve care. We hired local research coordinators for the hospitals and trained them how to collect accurate information on deaths and complications. We were conservative about what counted. The complications had to be significant: a pneumonia, a heart attack, bleeding requiring a return to the operating room or more than 4 units of blood, a documented wound infection, or the like. And the occurrence had to actually be witnessed in the hospital, not reported from elsewhere. We collected data on the surgical care in up to 4 operating rooms at each facility for about 3 months before the checklist went into effect. It was a kind of biopsy of the care received by patients across the range of hospitals in the world, and the results were sobering. Of the close to 4,000 adult surgical patients we followed, more than 400 developed major complications resulting from surgery. 56 of them died. About half the complications involved infections. Another quarter involved technical failures that required a return trip to the operating room to stop bleeding or repair a problem. The overall complication rates ranged from 6% to 21%. It's important to note that the operating rooms we were studying tended to handle the hospital's more complex procedures. More straightforward operations have lower injury rates. Nonetheless, the pattern confirmed what we'd understood. Surgery is risky and dangerous wherever it is done. We also found, as we suspected we would, signs of substantial opportunity for improvement everywhere. None of the hospitals, for example, had a routine approach to ensure that teams had identified and prepared for cases with high blood loss risk, or conducted any kind of preoperative team briefing about patients. We track performance of 6 specific safety steps. The timely delivery of antibiotics, the use of a working pulse oximeter, the completion of a formal risk assessment for placing an airway tube, the verbal confirmation of the patient's identity and procedure, the appropriate placement of intravenous lines for patients who develop severe bleeding, and finally a complete accounting of sponges at the end of the procedure. These are basics, the surgical equivalent of unlocking the elevator controls before airplane takeoff. Nevertheless, we found gaps everywhere. The very best missed at least one of these minimum steps 6% of the time, 1 in every 16 patients. And on average, the hospitals missed one of them in a startling 2/3 of patients, whether in rich countries or poor. That is how flawed and inconsistent surgical care routinely is around the world. Then, starting in spring 2008, the pilot hospitals began implementing our 2-minute, 19-step surgery checklist. We knew better than to think that just dumping a pile of copies in their operating rooms was going to change anything. The hospital leaders committed to introducing the concept systematically. They made presentations not only to their surgeons, but also to their anesthetists, nurses, and other surgical personnel. We supplied the hospitals with their failure data so the staff could see what they were trying to address. We gave them some PowerPoint slides and a couple of YouTube videos, one demonstrating how to use the safe surgery checklist, and one, a bit more entertaining, entitled How Not to Use the Safe Surgery Checklist, showing how easy it is to screw everything up. We also asked the hospital leaders to introduce the checklist in just one operating room at first, ideally in procedures the chief surgeon was doing himself, with senior anesthesia and nursing staff taking part. There would surely be bugs to work out. Each hospital would have to adjust the order and wording of the checklist to suit its particular practices and terminology. Several were using translations. A few had already indicated they wanted to add extra checks. For some hospitals, the checklist would also compel systemic changes. For example, stocking more antibiotic supplies in the operating rooms. We needed the first groups using the checklist to have the seniority and patience to make the necessary modifications and not dismiss the whole enterprise. Using the checklist involved a major cultural change as well, a shift in authority, responsibility, and expectations about care, and the hospitals needed to recognize that. We gambled that their staff would be far more likely to adopt the checklist if they saw their leadership accepting it from the outset. My team and I hit the road, fanning out to visit the pilot sites as the checklist effort got underway. I had never seen surgery performed in so many different kinds of settings. The contrasts were even starker than I had anticipated, and the range of problems was infinitely wider. In Tanzania, the hospital was 200 miles of sometimes one-lane dirt roads from the capital, Dar es Salaam, and flooding during the rainy season cut off supplies, such as medications and anesthetic gases, sometimes for weeks at a time. There were thousands of surgery patients, but just 5 surgeons and 4 anesthesia staff. None of the anesthetists had a medical degree. The patients' families supplied most of the blood for the blood bank, and when that wasn't enough, staff members rolled up their sleeves. They conserved anesthetic supplies by administering mainly spinal anesthesia, injections of numbing medication directly into the spinal canal. They could do operations under spinal that I never conceived of. They saved and re-sterilized their surgical gloves, using them over and over until holes appeared. They even made their own surgical gauze, the nurses and anesthesia staff sitting around an old wooden table at tea time each afternoon, cutting bolts of white cotton cloth to size for the next day's cases. In Delhi, the charity hospital was not as badly off as the Tanzanian site or hospitals I'd been to in rural India. There were more supplies. The staff members were better trained. But the volume of patients they were asked to care for in this city of 13 million was beyond comprehension. The hospital had 7 fully trained anesthetists, for instance, but they had to perform 20,000 operations a year. To provide a sense of how ludicrous this is, our New Zealand pilot hospital employed 92 anesthetists to manage a similar magnitude of surgery. Yet for all the equipment shortages, power outages, waiting lists, 14-hour days, I heard less unhappiness and complaining from the surgical staff in Delhi than in many American hospitals I've been to. The differences were not just between rich and poor settings either. Each site was distinctive. St. Mary's Hospital, for example, our London site, was a compound of red brick and white stone buildings more than a century and a half old, sprawling over a city block in Paddington. Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin here in 1928. More recently, under its chairman of surgery, Lord Darcy of Denham, the hospital has become an international pioneer in the development of minimally invasive surgery and surgical simulation. St. Mary's is modern, well-equipped, and a draw for London's powerful and well-to-do. Prince William and Prince Harry were born here, for example, and Conservative Party leader David Cameron's severely disabled son was cared for here as well. But it is hardly posh. It remains a government hospital in the National Health Service, serving any Briton without charge or distinction. Walking through St. Mary's 16 operating rooms, I found they look much the same as the ones where I work in Boston. High-tech, up-to-date. But surgical procedures seemed different at every stage. The patients were put to sleep outside the operating theater instead of inside, and then wheeled in, which meant that the first part of the checklist would have to be changed. The anesthetists and circulating nurses didn't wear masks, which seemed like sacrilege to me, although I had to admit their necessity is unproven for staff who do not work near the patient's incision. Almost every term the surgical teams used was unfamiliar. We all supposedly spoke English, but I was often unsure what they were talking about. In Jordan, the working environment was also at once recognizable and alien, but in a different way. The operating rooms in Amman had 0 frills. This was a still-developing country, and the equipment was older and heavily used. But they had most of the things I am used to as a surgeon, and the level of care seemed very good. One of the surgeons I met was Iraqi. He trained in Baghdad and practiced there until the chaos following the American invasion in 2003 forced him to flee with his family, abandoning their home, their savings, and his work. Before Saddam Hussein, in the last years of his rule, gutted the Iraqi medical system, Baghdad had provided some of the best medical care in the Middle East. But, the surgeon said, Jordan now seemed positioned to take that role, and he felt fortunate to be there. I learned that more than 200,000 foreign patients travel to Jordan for their health care each year, generating as much as $1 billion in revenues for the country. What I couldn't work out, though, was how the country's strict gender divide was negotiated in its operating rooms. I remember sitting outside a restaurant the day I arrived, studying the people passing by. Men and women were virtually always separated. Most women covered their hair. I got to know one of the surgery residents, a young man in his late 20s, who was my guide for the visit. We even went out to see a movie together. When I learned he had a girlfriend of 2 years, a graduate student, I asked him how long it was before he got to see her hair. "I never have," he said. "Come on, never?" "Never." He'd seen a few strands. He knew she had dark brown hair, but even in the more modern dating relationship of a partly westernized, highly educated couple, that was it. In the operating rooms, all the surgeons were men. Most of the nurses were women. The anesthetists split half and half. Given the hierarchies, I wondered whether the kind of teamwork envisioned by the checklist was even possible. The women wore their headscarves in the operating rooms. Most avoided eye contact with men. I slowly learned, however, that not all was what it seemed. The staff didn't hesitate to discard the formalities when necessary. I saw a gallbladder operation in which the surgeon inadvertently contaminated his glove while adjusting the operating lights. He hadn't noticed, but the nurse had. "You have to change your glove," the nurse told him in Arabic. Someone translated for me. "It's fine," the surgeon said. "No, it's not," the nurse said. "Don't be stupid." Then she made him change his glove. For all the differences among the 8 hospitals, I was nonetheless surprised by how readily one could feel at home in an operating room, wherever it might be. Once a case was underway, it was still surgery. You still had a human being on the table, with his hopes and his fears, and his body opened up to you, trusting you to do right by him. And you still had a group of people striving to work together with enough skill and commitment to warrant that trust. The introduction of the checklist was rocky at times. We had our share of logistical hiccups. In Manila, for instance, it turned out there was only one nurse for every 4 operations because qualified operating nurses kept getting snapped up by American and Canadian hospitals. The medical students who filled in were often too timid to start the checklist, so the anesthesia staff had to be persuaded to take on the task. In Britain, the local staff had difficulties figuring out the changes needed to accommodate their particular anesthesia practices. There was a learning curve as well. However straightforward the checklist might appear, if you were used to getting along without one, incorporating it into the routine is not always a smooth process. Sometimes teams forgot to carry out part of the checklist, especially the sign-out, before taking the patient from the room. Other times they found adhering to it just too hard, though not because doing so was complicated. Instead, the difficulty seemed to be social. It felt strange to people just to get their mouths around the words. For a nurse to say, for example, that if antibiotics hadn't been given, then everyone needed to stop and give them before proceeding. Each person has his or her style in the operating room, especially surgeons. Some are silent, some are moody, some are chatty. Very few knew immediately how to adapt their style to huddling with everyone, even the nursing student, for a systematic run-through of the plans and possible issues. The introduction of names and roles at the start of an operating day proved a point of particularly divided view. From Delhi to Seattle, the nurses seemed especially grateful for the step, but the surgeons were sometimes annoyed by it. Nonetheless, most complied. Most, but not all. We were thrown out of operating rooms all over the world. "This checklist is a waste of time," we were told. In a couple places, the hospital leaders wanted to call the curmudgeons on the carpet and force them to use it. We discouraged this. Forcing the obstinate few to adopt the checklist might cause a backlash that would sour others on participating. We asked the leaders to present the checklist as simply a tool for people to try in hopes of improving their results. After all, it remained possible that the detractors were right, that the checklist would prove just another well-meaning effort with no significant effect whatsoever. Pockets of resistance notwithstanding, the safe surgery checklist effort was well underway within a month in each location, with teams regularly using the checklist in every operating room we were studying. We continued monitoring the patient data. I returned home to wait out the results. I was nervous about the project. We had planned to examine the results for only a short time period, about 3 months in each pilot site after introduction of the checklist. That way, any changes we observed would likely be the consequence of the checklist and not of long-term ongoing trends in health or medical care. But I worried whether anything could really change in so short a time. The teams were clearly still getting the hang of things. Perhaps we hadn't given them enough time to learn. I also worried about how meager the intervention was when you got right down to it. We'd provided no new equipment, staff, or clinical resources to hospitals. The poor places were still poor, and we had to wonder whether improvement in their results was really possible without changing that. All we'd done was give them a one-page, 19-item list and shown them how to use it. We'd worked hard to make it short and simple, but perhaps we'd made it too short and too simple, not detailed enough. Maybe we shouldn't have listened to the aviation gurus. We began to hear some encouraging stories, however. In London, during a knee replacement by an orthopedic surgeon who was one of our toughest critics, the checklist brought the team to recognize, before incision and the point of no return, that the knee prosthesis on hand was the wrong size for the patient, and that the right size was not available in the hospital. The surgeon became an instant checklist proponent. In India, we learned, the checklist led the surgery department to recognize a fundamental flaw in its system of care. Usual procedure was to infuse the pre-surgery antibiotic into patients in the pre-operative waiting area before wheeling them in. But the checklist brought the clinicians to realize that frequent delays in the operating schedule meant the antibiotic had usually worn off hours before incision. So the hospital staff shifted their routine in line with the checklist and waited to give the antibiotic until patients were in the operating room. In Seattle, a friend who had joined the surgical staff at the University of Washington Medical Center told me how easily the checklist had fit into her operating room's routine. But was it helping them catch errors, I asked. No question, she said. They'd caught problems with antibiotics, equipment, overlooked medical issues. But more than that, she thought going through the checklist helped the staff respond better when they ran into trouble later, like bleeding or technical difficulties during the operation. We just work better together as a team, she said. The stories gave me hope. In October 2008, the results came in. I had two research fellows, both of them residents in general surgery, working on the project with me. Alex Haynes had taken more than a year away from surgical training to run the 8-city pilot study and compile the data. Tom Weiser had spent 2 years managing development of the WHO checklist program, and he'd been in charge of double-checking the numbers. A retired cardiac surgeon, William Berry, was the triple check on everything they did. Late one afternoon, they all came in to see me. "You've got to see this," Alex said. He laid a sheaf of statistical printouts in front of me and walked me through the tables. The final results showed that the rate of major complications for surgical patients in all 8 hospitals fell by 36% after introduction of the checklist. Deaths fell 47%. The results had far outstripped what we dared to hope for, and all were statistically highly significant. Infections fell by almost half. The number of patients having to return to the operating room after their original operations because of bleeding or other technical problems fell by 1/4. Overall, in this group of nearly 4,000 patients, 435 would have been expected to develop serious complications based on our earlier observation data, but instead, just 277 did. Using the checklist had spared more than 150 people from harm, and 27 of them from death. You might think that I'd have danced a jig on my desk, that I'd have gone running through the operating room hallways yelling, "It worked! It worked!" But this is not what I did. Instead, I became very, very nervous. I started poking through the pile of data looking for mistakes, for problems, for anything that might upend the results. Suppose, I said, this improvement wasn't due to the checklist. Maybe, just by happenstance, the teams had done fewer emergency cases and other risky operations in the second half of the study, and that's why their results looked better. Alex went back and ran the numbers again. Nope, it turned out. The teams had actually done slightly more emergency cases in the checklist period than before. And the mix of types of operations, obstetric, thoracic, orthopedic, abdominal, was unchanged. Suppose this was just a Hawthorne effect, that is to say, a byproduct of being observed in a study rather than proof of the checklist's power. In about 20% of the operations, after all, a researcher had been physically present in the operating room collecting information. Maybe the observer's presence was what had improved care. The research team pointed out, however, that the observers had been in the operating rooms from the very beginning of the project, and the results had not leaped upward until the checklist was introduced. Moreover, we'd tracked which operations had an observer and which ones hadn't. And when Alex rechecked the data, the results proved no different. The improvements were equally dramatic for observed and unobserved operations. Okay, maybe the checklist made a difference in some places, but perhaps only in the poor sites. No, that didn't turn out to be the case either. The baseline rate of surgical complications was indeed lower in the four hospitals in high-income countries. But introducing the checklist had produced a 1/3 decrease in major complications for the patients in those hospitals as well. Also, a highly significant reduction. The team took me through the results for each of the 8 hospitals, one by one. In every site, introduction of the checklist had been accompanied by a substantial reduction in complications. In 7 out of 8, it was a double-digit percentage drop. This thing was real. In January 2009, the New England Journal of Medicine published our study as a rapid release article. Even before then, word began to leak out as we distributed the findings to our pilot sites. Hospitals in Washington State learned of Seattle's results and began trying the checklist themselves. Pretty soon, they'd formed a coalition with the state's insurers, Boeing, and the governor to systematically introduce the checklist across the state and track detailed data. In Great Britain, Lord Darcy, the chairman of surgery at St. Mary's Hospital, had meanwhile been made a minister of health. When he and the country's top designate to WHO, Sir Liam Donaldson, who had also pushed for the surgery project in the first place, saw the study results, they launched a campaign to implement the checklist nationwide. The reaction of surgeons was more mixed. Even if using the checklist didn't take the time many feared, indeed, in several hospitals, teams reported that it saved them time, some objected that the study had not clearly established how the checklist was producing such dramatic results. This was true. In our 8 hospitals, we saw improvements in administering antibiotics to reduce infections, in use of oxygen monitoring during operations, in making sure teams had the right patient and right procedure before making an incision. But these particular improvements could not explain why unrelated complications like bleeding fell, for example. We surmised that improved communication was the key. Spot surveys of random staff members coming out of surgery after the checklist was in effect did indeed report a significant increase in the level of communication. There was also a notable correlation between teamwork scores and results for patients. The greater the improvement in teamwork, the greater the drop in complications. Perhaps the most revealing information, however, was simply what the staff told us. More than 250 staff members, surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses, and others, filled out an anonymous survey after 3 months of using the checklist. In the beginning, most had been skeptical, but by the end, 80% reported that the checklist was easy to use, did not take a long time to complete, and had improved the safety of care. and 78% actually observed the checklist to have prevented an error in the operating room. Nonetheless, some skepticism persisted. After all, 20% did not find it easy to use, thought it took too long, and felt it had not improved the safety of care. Then we asked the staff one more question. If you were having an operation, we asked, would you want the checklist to be used? A full 93% said yes. Chapter 8. The Hero in the Age of Checklists. We have an opportunity before us, not just in medicine, but in virtually any endeavor. Even the most expert among us can gain from searching out the patterns of mistakes and failures and putting a few checks in place. But will we do it? Are we ready to grab onto the idea? It is far from clear. Take the Safe Surgery Checklist. If someone discovered a new drug that could cut down surgical complications with anything remotely like the effectiveness of the checklist, we would have television ads with minor celebrities extolling its virtues. Detail men would offer free lunches to get doctors to make it part of their practice. Government programs would research it. Competitors would jump in to make newer and better versions. If the checklist were a medical device, we would have surgeons clamoring for it, lining up at display booths at surgical conferences to give it a try, hounding their hospital administrators to get one for them, because damn it, doesn't providing good care matter to those pencil pushers? That's what happened when surgical robots came out. Drool-inducing 22nd century $1.7 million remote-controlled machines, designed to help surgeons do laparoscopic surgery with more maneuverability inside patients' bodies and fewer complications. The robots increased surgical costs massively and have so far improved results only modestly for a few operations compared with standard laparoscopy. Nonetheless, hospitals in the United States and abroad have spent billions of dollars on them. But meanwhile, the checklist? Well, it hasn't been ignored. Since the results of the WHO Safe Surgery Checklist were made public, more than a dozen countries, including Australia, Brazil, Canada, Costa Rica, Ecuador, France, Ireland, Jordan, New Zealand, the Philippines, Spain, and the United Kingdom, have publicly committed to implementing versions of it in hospitals nationwide. Some are taking the additional step of tracking results, which is crucial for ensuring the checklist is being put in place successfully. In the United States, hospital associations in 20 states have pledged to doing the same. By the end of 2009, about 10% of American hospitals had either adopted the checklist or taken steps to implement it, and worldwide, more than 2,000 hospitals had. This is all encouraging. Nonetheless, we doctors remain a long way from actually embracing the idea. The checklist has arrived in our operating rooms, mostly from the outside in and from the top down. It has come from finger-wagging health officials, who are regarded by surgeons as more or less the enemy, or from jug-eared hospital safety officers, who are about as beloved as the playground safety patrol. Sometimes it is the chief of surgery who brings it in, which means we must complain under our breath rather than raise a holy tirade. But it is regarded as an irritation, as interference on our terrain. This is my patient, this is my operating room, and the way I carry out an operation is my business and my responsibility. So who do these people think they are, telling me what to do? Now, if surgeons end up using the checklist anyway, what is the big deal if we do so without joy in our souls? We're doing it. That's what matters, right? Not necessarily. Just ticking boxes is not the ultimate goal here. Embracing a culture of teamwork and discipline is. And if we recognize the opportunity, the 2-minute WHO checklist is just a start. It is a single broad-brush device intended to catch a few problems common to all operations, and we surgeons could build on it to do even more. We could adopt, for example, specialized checklists for hip replacement procedures, pancreatic operations, aortic aneurysm repairs, examining each of our major procedures for their most common avoidable glitches, and incorporating checks to help us steer clear of them. We could even devise emergency checklists, like aviation has, for non-routine situations, such as the cardiac arrest my friend John described, in which the doctors forgot that an overdose of potassium could be a cause. Beyond the operating room, moreover, there are hundreds, perhaps thousands of things doctors do that are as dangerous and prone to error as surgery. Take, for instance, the treatment of heart attacks, strokes, drug overdoses, pneumonias, kidney failures, seizures, and consider the many other situations that are only seemingly simpler and less dire. The evaluation of a patient with a headache, for example, a funny chest pain, a lung nodule, a breast lump. All involve risk, uncertainty, and complexity, and therefore steps that are worth committing to a checklist and testing in routine care. Good checklists could become as important for doctors and nurses as good stethoscopes, which, unlike checklists, have never been proved to make a difference in patient care. The hard question, still unanswered, is whether medical culture can seize the opportunity. Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff tells the story of our first astronauts and charts the demise of the maverick Chuck Yeager test pilot culture of the 1950s. It was a culture defined by how unbelievably dangerous the job was. Test pilots strapped themselves into machines of barely controlled power and complexity, and a quarter of them were killed on the job. The pilots had to have focus, daring, wits, and an ability to improvise. The right stuff. But as knowledge of how to control the risks of flying accumulated, as checklists and flight simulators became more prevalent and sophisticated, the danger diminished. Values of safety and conscientiousness prevailed, and the rock star status of the test pilots was gone. Something like this is going on in medicine. We have the means to make some of the most complex and dangerous work we do, in surgery, emergency care, ICU medicine, and beyond, more effective than we ever thought possible. But the prospect pushes against the traditional culture of medicine, with its central belief that in situations of high risk and complexity, what you want is a kind of expert audacity, the right stuff, again. Checklists and standard operating procedures feel like exactly the opposite, and that's what rankles many people. It's ludicrous, though, to suppose that checklists are going to do away with the need for courage, wits, and improvisation. The work of medicine is too intricate and individual for that. Good clinicians will not be able to dispense with expert audacity, yet we should also be ready to accept the virtues of regimentation. And it is true well beyond medicine. The opportunity is evident in many fields. And so also is the resistance. Finance offers one example. Recently, I spoke to Monish Pabrai, managing partner in Pabrai Investment Funds in Irvine, California. He is one of three investors I've recently met who have taken a page from medicine and aviation to incorporate formal checklists into their work. All three are huge investors. Pabrai runs a $500 million portfolio. Guy Speer is head of Aquamarine Capital Management in Zurich, Switzerland, a $70 million fund. The third did not want to be identified by name or to reveal the size of the fund where he is a director, but it is one of the biggest in the world and worth billions. The three consider themselves value investors, investors who buy shares in under-recognized, undervalued companies. They don't time the market. They don't buy according to some computer algorithm. They do intensive research, look for good deals, and invest for the long run. They aim to buy Coca-Cola before everyone realizes it's going to be Coca-Cola. Pabrai described what this involves. Over the last 15 years, he's made a new investment or two per quarter, and he's found it requires in-depth investigation of 10 or more prospects for each one he finally buys stock in. The ideas can bubble up from anywhere, a billboard advertisement, a newspaper article about real estate in Brazil, a mining journal he decides to pick up for some random reason. He reads broadly and looks widely. He has his eyes open for the glint of a diamond in the dirt, of a business about to boom. He hits upon hundreds of possibilities, but most drop away after cursory examination. Every week or so, though, he spots one that starts his pulse racing. It seems surefire. He can't believe no one else has caught onto it yet. He begins to think it could make him tens of millions of dollars if he plays it right. No, this time, maybe hundreds of millions. "You go into greed mode," he said. Guy Speer called it cocaine brain. Neuroscientists have found that the prospect of making money stimulates the same primitive reward circuits in the brain that cocaine does. And that, Pabrai said, is when serious investors like himself try to become systematic. They focus on dispassionate analysis, on avoiding both irrational exuberance and panic. They pore over the company's financial reports, investigate its liabilities and risks, examine its management team's track record, weigh its competitors, consider the future of the market it is in, trying to gauge both the magnitude of opportunity and the margin of safety. The patron saint of value investors is Warren Buffett, among the most successful financiers in history and one of the two richest men in the world, even after the losses he suffered in the crash of 2008. Pabrai has studied every deal Buffett and his company, Berkshire Hathaway, have made, good or bad, and read every book he could find about them. He even pledged $650,000 at a charity auction to have lunch with Buffett. "Warren," Pabrai said, and after a $650,000 lunch, I guess first names are in order, Warren uses a mental checklist process when looking at potential investments. So that's more or less what Pabrai did from his fund's inception. He was disciplined. He made sure to take his time when studying a company. The process could require weeks. And he did very well following this method, but not always, he found. He also made mistakes, some of them disastrous. These were not mistakes merely in the sense that he lost money on his bets or missed making money on investments he'd rejected. That's bound to happen. Risk is unavoidable in Pabrai's line of work. No, these were mistakes in the sense that he had miscalculated the risks involved, made errors of analysis. For example, looking back, he noticed that he had repeatedly erred in determining how leveraged companies were, how much cash was really theirs, how much was borrowed, and how risky those debts were. The information was available. He just hadn't looked for it carefully enough. In large part, he believes, the mistakes happened because he wasn't able to damp down the cocaine brain. Pabrai is a 45-year-old former engineer. He comes from India, where he clawed his way up its fiercely competitive educational system. Then he secured admission to Clemson University in South Carolina to study engineering. From there, he climbed the ranks of technology companies in Chicago and California. Before going into investment, he built a successful informational technology company of his own. All this is to say he knows a thing or two about being dispassionate and avoiding the lure of instant gratification. Yet no matter how objective he tried to be about a potentially exciting investment, he said, he found his brain working against him, latching on to evidence that confirmed his initial hunch and dismissing the signs of a downside. It's what the brain does. "You get seduced," he said. "You start cutting corners." Or, in the midst of a bear market, the opposite happens. "You go into fear mode," he said. "You see people around you losing their bespoke shirts, and you overestimate the dangers." He also found he made mistakes in handling complexity. A good decision requires looking at so many different features of companies in so many ways that even without the cocaine brain, he was missing obvious patterns. His mental checklist wasn't good enough. "I am not Warren," he said. "I don't have a 300 IQ. He needed an approach that could work for someone with an ordinary IQ. So he devised a written checklist. Apparently, Buffett himself could have used one. Pabrai noticed that even he made certain repeated mistakes. That's when I knew he wasn't really using a checklist, Pabrai said. So Pabrai made a list of mistakes he'd seen, ones Buffett and other investors had made as well as his own. It soon contained dozens of different mistakes, he said. Then to help him guard against them, he devised a matching list of checks, about 70 in all. One, for example, came from a Berkshire Hathaway mistake he'd studied involving the company's purchase in early 2000 of Court Furniture, a Virginia-based rental furniture business. Over the previous 10 years, Court's business and profits had climbed impressively. Charles Munger, Buffett's longtime investment partner, believed Court was riding a fundamental shift in the American economy. The business environment had become more and more volatile, and companies therefore needed to grow and shrink more rapidly than ever before. As a result, they were increasingly apt to lease office space rather than buy it, and Munger noticed to lease the furniture too. Court was in a perfect position to benefit. Everything else about the company was measuring up. It had solid financials, great management, and so on. So Munger bought. But buying was an error. He had missed the fact that the three previous years of earnings had been driven entirely by the dot-com boom of the late 90s. Court was leasing furniture to hundreds of startup companies that suddenly stopped paying their bills and evaporated when the boom collapsed. Munger and Buffett saw the dot-com bubble a mile away, Pabrai said. These guys were completely clear. But they missed how dependent Court was on it. Munger later called his purchase a macroeconomic mistake. Court's earning power basically went from substantial to zero for a while, he confessed to his shareholders. So Pabrai added the following checkpoint to his list. When analyzing a company, stop and confirm that you've asked yourself whether the revenues might be overstated or understated due to boom or bust conditions. Like him, the anonymous investor I spoke to, I'll call him Cook, made a checklist. But he was even more methodical. He enumerated the errors known to occur at any point in the investment process, during the research phase, during decision-making, during execution of the decision, and even in the period after making an investment when one should be monitoring for problems. He then designed detailed checklists to avoid the errors, complete with clearly identified pause points at which he and his investment team